I don't know if we'll have more folks showing up or not, and if they are, they can join the party. But let's get started. We are still in Genesis, as everybody is well aware. We're in Genesis 32, and we're going to recap a couple quick things, but then we've got this last part of Genesis 32 to talk about, or I should say we could wrestle with that tonight. Nobody? Dang it. I worked on that joke all week. We can wrestle with the end of Genesis 32 tonight. Come on, guys. You're killing me. This is a tough room. It's a tough room. I'm just kidding. That's when he wrestles with God, okay?
So I'm just playing.
So anyway, we're going to look at that and try to figure out what the heck is going on with that, because it is weird. And unlike the rest of Genesis... I said we can wrestle with that end of Genesis 32 tonight. Oh. I was very proud of my joke, but
well,
no.
You know, you have some folks over here that probably need hearing aids like me.
No. I will speak up.
No,
it was very bad joke. It was a very bad joke. Not as bad as most of Andy's jokes, but pretty bad.
I am the one though that came up with Latter Day Saints.
That's true. The Latter Day Saint. That's true. That is a good one. Lordy, lordy, lordy. Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we welcome you in this place, and we thank you so much for this opportunity to come together tonight and study your word. Please be with us, be in our hearts and our minds, and protect us and lift us closer to you and give us your wisdom as we study. Be with everyone here and bless them. And bless this entire meeting. Keep everyone safe. And we pray these things in the mighty name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
So, there is so much weird, crazy stuff in the Bible. It's like one of my new favorite things. Because there's stuff that people just skip right over. You know, and we've talked about a lot of those things over the past, you know, months and months and months. We've been in Genesis now 9 months or whatever. So, but there's these weird things that happen that, and we don't really know anything about it till later. And we've talked about all the kinds of stuff like Lot or whatever. But the beginning of Genesis 32, which we went through last time, and we were basically concerned about the situation between Jacob and Esau. And Jacob, of course, is really, really worried about how that's going to come out. And he has fled Laban. He's taken his wives. He has chased him down. They've made a covenant. And then it says at the end of chapter 31 that Laban arose, kissed his sons and daughters, blessed them, and departs and returns to his place. And then Jacob moves on, and everything is cool, and he's going to move, you know, keep moving in the direction of Canaan. But then there's this little tiny two sentences that don't make any sense. I mean, they're fine. It's just, what's going on? Genesis 32 starts like this. So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp," and he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the county of Edom. And they just kind of just slide by this whole angel sighting. You know, Jacob's tooting along with all his camels and all of his stuff, and some angels of God are hanging out. And he's like, cool, hey guys. That is really weird. And cool, it's just really weird. So, why? Right? Why are they hanging out? You know, it's like the ladder thing. You know, we don't know how much of the ladder thing is real. You know, was it a vision that he had? More than likely. Were there really angels coming and going there? Possibly. What is there? Here's the question that I'm trying to get to, which is a very weird one. And as you know, we always are tackling weird questions. But are there certain places on the planet that things that are beyond a physical world come and go from? more often. This is a big one. Kind of a weird one. But for instance, was the place that he saw the ladder and the angels coming and going, was it a place that angels kind of come down? In Revelation, which we studied last, you know, last book we studied last year, there was a particular place on the planet where they went and unlocked stuff and let those like demon locust things out. But it was very clear from the text that there was a place. I don't know where it is, and I need to stay far away from it, but there seemed to be a place. So this is another time where he's going along and he sees angels, and I don't know if they're coming to see him or if they're hanging out. But see, here's the weird part, and this is why I'm bringing this up. They don't say anything to him. Jacob went on his way. The angels of God met him, so he sees them. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp," and he called the name of the place Mahanaim. And then that's it. And then he sends messengers before him to Esau, his brother. And I don't know what's going on. I think this is fascinating. Maybe this is God's camp. And maybe there is a place where there's just angels. I don't know. Maybe they're there to give him the idea, because angels are messengers. Maybe they're there to give him the idea to send those messengers to go to his brother. I don't know. But I just find stuff like that, because they just drop stuff like that at random in the Bible. They're just like a one sentence. You know, like, there was one where... is it Joshua? Yeah, it's Joshua. Joshua's about to attack, and he just has this little encounter with God or an angel or whatever, and it was like 5 seconds, and then like he's the general of something, and he keeps rolling. It's bizarre. It's really, to me, it's really cool, because nothing's here. Here's the next part of the point. There's nothing in here that's meaningless, right? There's no word out of place. There's no word without meaning. So there's reasons behind all these things, and I just find it fascinating. But the story we're in right now is the story of Jacob, and Jacob continues to be this absolutely fascinating character to me, because he's going to do another semi-shady thing pretty soon, and he just basically, and I realize I'm talking about the father of all of Israel, but he's a little bit of a character. I mean, not only does he put on the little skin and kind of fake his dad out originally to get the blessing, But he does all kinds of weird transactions. And he kind of is getting ready to blow Esau off in a second, too. It's just very strange. Jacob's character is interesting to me. And as usual, it's got a message for us. And the message for us is how God uses everyone and can use anybody, you know, from any background, with any frame of mind. If God takes hold of your life, he can do great things with you. Pretty much regardless of you, you know, no matter how weird you are or how, you know, lacking you are, it's pretty much irrelevant if God gets hold of you. Mm-hmm. You know, and he shows that over and over and over again. He'll take somebody that has very little in the way of, you know, well, think about the very first missionaries he picked when the, you know, announcement of Jesus' birth happened in the very beginning. He didn't go to the Sanhedrin. It didn't say, and the angels appeared before the Sanhedrin and saying, "Glory, glory, glory." And Sanhedrin fell on their knees. That doesn't say that. It would be nice if it said that. That would be so, make things a lot easier. Paul's life would have been a whole lot easier if that's what would happen. But he went to the shepherds, you know, out tending their flocks by night. Can you tell I'm looking forward to Christmas? Anyway, the shepherds are tending their flocks by night, and that's who they went to proclaim this. And the shepherds dropped everything and running into town like, "Oh my gosh, Jesus is here." I mean, the shepherds were so much cooler. I mean, I can see the angels appearing before the Sanhedrin, and they're like, "I don't know. We're going to talk about this. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense." You know? But anyway. But as we went through, we did a little bit of this last time, and we talked about how he sent these flocks and herds ahead, and he had this plan, right? And his plan was to send out all these wonderful gifts, all these goats and rams and camels and cows and donkeys. I mean, just sending out all. I mean, this is this is how wealth was determined in this period of time. So he's sending out great chests of gold in, you know, the 1700s or whatever. He's sending out all this wonderful wealth, and he's sending it in stages to increase the appearance, you know. Plus, he's given himself a little space. He's divided his troops. He's got a plan for dealing with Esau. He's a very tactical individual. He's very much dealing with a good plan. But when he sends everybody out, he's going to be left, you know, somewhat alone. So we're in 32:22. And I'm in New King James. Like I said, there's plenty of wonderful versions you can work from. And he arose that night and took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. This is a little river area near where Menahem is. Anyway, they're very close by. He took them and sent them over the brook and sent over what he had. And this left him alone. So now he's got all his guys going one way with stuff. He's got things divided. He's got these guys going to meet Esau. He's got his wife and kids and stuff, wives and kids with him. He sends them over across the river, so they're in a more protected area. He's alone, sort of in between everything. All right? And he's there. And it says, and I'm going to read what it says, and then we're going to try to figure out what it means. Okay? He took them, sent them over the brook, and sent over. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of day. First of all, okay, that's what it says. It says, a man wrestled with him to the break of day. Now, when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip went out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for day breaks. What is going on? Okay, first of all, everybody has always said this is God, and I'm fine with that, okay? But this God is not acting like he's not God. I mean, you understand what I mean by that? And he can't beat him. So he cheats and knocks his joint out of sight. What? What is going on? That's why I saved it for a whole class, right? Because everybody just reads it and goes, okay, and then he wrestles with God, because that like represents our lives, and we wrestle with God and wrestle with our fate. And we, okay, I get all that. But this is weird. Mm-hmm. So normally if we see God as a man, that's Jesus, right? Normally. Mm-hmm. So the man could very well be Jesus. So are we to believe that Jacob is tougher than Jesus, like as individuals? Let's say Jesus 30-ish, Jacob, we don't know for sure, but let's say 90-ish or whatever, okay? Is Jacob just tougher than Jesus? Like if Jesus and Jacob met in a ring, would Jacob just beat up on Jesus? That doesn't make any sense, right? First of all, Jesus is 30 years old and a carpenter. So if we just talk about just human males, this doesn't make sense. So you talk about, okay, so who else could it be? It could be an angel. It could be God, the Father, coming as a man, which would be the only time that happens that we see in the Bible specifically. Because usually if God, the Trinity, the triune God, comes to earth as a man, it's Jesus. That's the whole point, right, of Jesus. It could be a man that God picks to go and wrestle Jacob. It could be a vision. He could be left alone and pass out, fall asleep. They wrestle till the break of day. So they're wrestling all night long. First of all, why is Jacob wrestling a guy all night long? If I was walking along, let's say I was going to a campsite by 11 mile, and a guy just jumped to me and we started wrestling. We wouldn't wrestle all night long for a lot of reasons, okay? But that is just odd. It doesn't mention here anything theological or philosophical or visionary.
It has capitals, though, for man and beast.
Right, but those capitals aren't in the original text, right? Mm-hmm. So the original text has no capital letters. Everything's a capital letter in the original text. In ancient Hebrew, which is what this is written in, and in Greek, which is what the New Testament's in, there are no capitals. So the capitals have been decided on by, and we can trust the church council, but the capitals and the punctuations and the divisions are all editorial, right? So it's the word for man in the original, but it's not capitalized. They give us that. So what happened here? Editorially, and I'm not mad at that, I'm just explaining. Editorially, the commission creating the translation into English made a decision that man is indeed God, the theological decision that man is indeed God. So they capitalized the M and they capitalized the H for the he in the next section, so you know that he is the one who pops out. So why on earth, if let's just go with God as becomes a man and wrestles Jacob, okay? Why on earth would he pop his... Okay, he can't beat him, which makes no sense, right? Because God could just become a man slightly stronger than Jacob at any moment. He seems to want to win. Now, why does he pop the socket of his hip out? Like, I don't get it. Like, if he wants to win, just win. You're God, right?
Maybe he didn't want to go anywhere.
Maybe he wants to slow him down. Maybe there's a God reason for popping that joint. It seems unusual that he would be like, you know, cheating. That doesn't make any sense. Unless it's actually a man. But if it was an actual man, then he would have to have magical powers to pop a guy's hip out. Like, pow, right? So it's not a man. Okay? It's obviously wrestling with God, as we've all learned through our lives. Is this not bizarre? Yes.
When you read it, okay, so did the man touch his hollow of his thigh and Jacob's automatically went out of joint when you read it? Can it be interpreted that way?
He touched the socket of his hip and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with. I mean, that's one way to read it. But then he says, "Let me go for the day breaks." I got two questions about this sentence. Question number one, why does God need to ask Jacob to let him go? Mm-hmm. And second of all, why does he need to go before daybreak? Is this like the vampire version of God? I don't understand why he has to go before daybreak.
The sidebar Pentecostal preacher comment is,
yes,
anyone who wrestles with God will always walk with a limp.
There
that's
you go.
Point number four in some sermon that I...
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Well, Jacob is the deceiver.
Yeah, is he trying to correct him from being like a weirdo? The problem, the things that Jacob's done that are, you know, deceptive and weird, is he trying to... Or does Jacob represent something? Who's wrestling with who?
Because very, very close by, God is going to change his name.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Is it the demonstration of a struggle?
Yeah, and how is Jacob... I'm in love with this passage because it's so crazy. Because Jacob says, I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me. It's like,
I got God in the headlock. Come on, you bless me. You just bless me right now.
For real. That's what it says. That's nuts. And God's like, you know, and explain this. So he says to him, so God says to Jacob, what is your name? So yeah, so he's walk. So God just decides to wrestle a random guy he doesn't know in the middle of the night, and they're equal. So he's, he said, Jacob. He said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. And Jacob asked him, saying, tell me your name, I pray. And he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. I don't know what kind of mood God was in. I don't know what is really going on, but this is so much fun. Okay, so they're messing with each other. And they wrestled all night, to a standstill. And even when he pops his hip out of joint, Jacob still has him in a headlock. I'm not letting you go. I don't care if you break my hip. Bless me. This is literally one of the weirdest things in the entire Bible. People roll right through it like everybody wrestles with God, blah, blah, blah. But it's literally one of the weirdest things in the whole Bible. Now, obviously, I have a theoretical, theological answer. I believe, remember how we've been seeing all this foreshadowing of Jesus with Jacob? How we've seen he'll see like people watering things, and it'll be this foreshadowing of bringing the sheep and all that stuff. We've been seeing all this foreshadowing in these chapters, and it's pointing forward. And I mean, the prophets are much more direct, but we're seeing these things like water my sheep type foreshadowing things. Well, what is this? What is this a foreshadowing of? Well, you've got God and probably Jesus being reduced to human form, but giving up godly priorities, godly prerogatives, becoming a man capable of wrestling Jacob and losing, which he set up on purpose. Now, he doesn't have to do that. He could become a stronger person than Jacob easily, right? Or beat Jacob. He's going to bless him and mess his hip up. Probably related to each other. There's probably a reason. Like, if you're limping along, if you could move faster, you might just get in traffic and get hit by a truck. But since you're limping, you live, you know? So there's always a God plan involving in everything. But this is God, follow this, becoming a man and being overcome by men. But then, even though he's overcome by men, he's blessing them. And who are they? They're Israel. Does that make sense? So it's like a foreshadow. And what does Israel do with God until the current day and far into the future? What is Israel
wrestling
doing with God? Wrestling. Mm-hmm. Wrestling with God. Israel's confused. Mm-hmm. Why is Israel confused? Because God became a man. Are you understanding what I'm saying? Israel's confused because God was a man.
Yes.
Jesus.
And they're refusing to believe it.
Right. So this seems like an overarching predecessor, you know, like a prequel or whatever. Because it's Israel, which is what Jacob's name becomes. And he's wrestling with God. And God is being, you know, it's an even match or even being overcome. And yet, even though he still blesses him. And when does he have to go?
Before daybreak.
Before daybreak. Why? Because Mary's coming. Are you with me? Mary Magdalene's coming to the tomb. He's got to go before daybreak. Now, I'm just saying. If I'm looking at a guy wrestling God, when God's a man, and then able to overcome him and hold him down and say, bless me, you know, and God's trying to, you know, mess with him with his hip and all that. I mean, this is a summary story of Israel and Jesus. And yet he blesses him anyway. It's fascinating to me. This may be, there's a couple reasons for the names, right? What is your name? Now, God knows his name, so why does he say, what is your name? Just like God knows Adam and Eve are in the garden, he's like, where are you guys at? He doesn't need to ask where they're at. But that's because he's eliciting a response. Mm-hmm. He wants you to say your name, and because he's going to change it. So he says, my name is Jacob. And he's like, you're no longer Jacob. You're Israel. You've struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. And I would have to say that in certain circumstances, and obviously we have the rest of the story still coming, but Israel has struggled with God and man and has in many ways prevailed. You know, it's a pretty good summary, even where we're sitting. And he asked for his name, and he says, why would you ask me my name? But in other words, you know who I am. And he blesses him. So Jacob calls the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. And he says that's a reference to who God is and to Moses, right? Because you're not supposed to put a look on God. And you're not, and he's obviously not looking on the fullness of God. God's reduced himself to a man. That's why they're wrestling. If he was looking on the fullness of God, he would be destroyed, just like Moses, right? So he can't look on the fullness of God. But he has looked on God face to face, and he has lived through it. So he crossed over Peniel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip.
Would that have happened so that Esau, when he saw him limping, would have pity on him?
That's very possible. See, it's all possible. To this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle, that muscle that's right there on that hip socket. Like, that's part of the law of you don't eat that area right there, which that's mind-boggling. That's what... They don't eat that muscle, that section right there. They set that aside. It's just, could it be because he needs to slow down? Could it be because God's making a point, or he needed to see some kind of miracle to know it was God? Could it be because Esau might have pity on him? I don't know. But he gets blessed nonetheless in person. And he crosses over the river limping, and the sun rises on him. And I think about that, the way that is it's a tendon or a muscle that, some people say it's a muscle that shrank, some people say it's a tendon that broke. But there's damage done in this battle, right? But the damage is not... It's not two things. Just more weird theology for you. It's not two things. One of the things it's not is blood. There's no blood let in the battle, which is important. Because he's not Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. So foreshadowing. And there's also no bones broken in the battle. So we have two more types of foreshadowing in the wrestling with God, in Israel wrestling with God. But it could be, you know, even more sort of a funny symbolism. For instance, now he's going to be slow. Israel has been slow to come around, right? It could be something as funny as that. Israel is slow to come around.
Very slow.
Yeah, very slow. So now we move to Genesis 33. And Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming. And with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants, and he put the maidservants and the children in the front. And this is raw right here, you guys. This is just raw. He puts the maidservants and their children in front, and then Leah and her children behind them, and then Rachel and Joseph at the back. Because if he starts killing, they're going to be able to escape, right? So he's like, let the maidservants and their kids die first. It's terrible. No, Jacob does stuff like this all the time. He does stuff like this all the time. But he has Joseph in the back. So he crosses over before them. Now he's brave. I mean, he's not a weak guy. He just is organized in his own way. But he crosses over before him, bows himself to the ground seven times until he comes near his brother. This is a very ancient ritualistic approach. Just like all the stuff. But Esau ran to meet him and embrace him. and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. When he lifted his eyes, he saw the women and children. He said, "Who are these with you?" So he said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the maidservants came near, they and all their children, and bowed down. And then Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterwards Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. Then Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company which I met?" And he said, "These are to find favor in the sight of my Lord." In other words, he's talking about all those presents and all those people he sent out in front of him. And Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." And Jacob said, "No, please. If I have found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face, and though I had seen, as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me. Please take my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." So he urged him, and he took it. Then Esau said, "Let us take our journey. Let us go, and I will before you." And this is where we're going to get to Andy's point, okay? Because this is one of two different things. But Jacob said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are weak, and the flocks and herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die. Please let my Lord go ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord in Seir." So he's saying, "I can't leave everybody behind. You guys, you've got your soldiers and yourself, and you guys are moving quick. I need to be back here." But what's not mentioned is the fact that he has a hip problem, right? So he really does need to move slower. And God might have done that to either give him the idea or to, you know, make it so he couldn't keep up with him or whatever. But this is fascinating what happens, because Esau said, "So I'll leave some of my people with you. You know, some guards. Because you're traveling with just women and children and, you know, some herds and some stuff." But now, so Jacob says to Esau, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth, built himself a house, and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the place the name is called Succoth. So that last sentence is another stumper. So he says, "Esau, go on ahead with all your guys. We're going to ramble on, follow you. We're going to meet you over there." And he doesn't go there. He goes to a completely different place, builds a house, makes a big place for his livestock, and settles in a completely different area. So, why? Right? Why didn't he just go be with his brother? Is he avoiding his brother?
He did threaten to kill him.
He did threaten to kill him. Does he think maybe it's a setup? Like, if I go over there, it's all a setup. He's going to kill me. But Esau is so glad to see him. Is Esau planning to kill him, or has he forgotten about all that from a long time ago? Esau seems to have, you know, forgotten about everything. And that would fit Esau's character. Remember, he kind of forgets about stuff a lot, and he kind of, like, wants stew more than his birthright. So, I mean, he's not the kind of guy who, you know, probably holds on to something for a really long time. He probably has forgiven and forgotten. It's also another foreshadowing of what's going to happen with Joseph when he meets Jacob again in Egypt. Because everybody's expecting drama. You know, in this case, Jacob is expecting drama from Esau because he's got an army and power, but he gives him all love. In that case, Jacob's expecting problems from Joseph because the kids have sold him into slavery. Now he's got an army and power in Egypt. And in both cases, there's weeping and hugging and kissing because everybody is so happy to be back together. And the person that they're worried about is not thinking about that. They're just happy to have this person back safe and sound in their lives. It's like your kid goes off and goes to some city and does some really shady stuff for a few years, and you think they're dead, and they come back, and they're all scared to come home because they're like, I just disappeared, and they're going to kill me, and I can't believe I didn't even send a note. And all you're and all you think when you see them is, oh, my God, you're alive. You know, can I hug them and kiss them and, like, jump up and down with joy, and they're, like, just in shock, right? It's that kind of deal. But I don't know. Jacob, he said, I'm going to be right there. And then, boom, sidetrack over to Sukkoth, building a house. That's just, Jacob continues to just be a weirdo, man. I don't know how to describe him. He just continues to do what he wants to do. And it's just, there's just so much strange, odd things about Jacob. There's going to be trouble because of it. So I don't know if it has to do with the hip thing. I don't know if we needed him to move over there because of particular reason. You know, I know that there's going to be all kinds of things that are going to shake out here when it comes to locations. But Esau ends up creating an entire area, and the problem is that area might not really be Canaan. So geologically, we're talking about an area that might not really match the blessing, right? Because he's going to end up being the father of Edom, right? And this place, Seir, where they're going, refers to an area around a mountain of the same name, Mount Seir. And this is the southern area of Edom. This mountain has been used traditionally to mark the border between Edom and Judah. Right? So, it's sort of like the historic... Well, historically, Egypt used it in their conquering and controlling of Canaan. My point is that on the surface, it seems like Jacob sort of blows him off. But I think, on looking a little closer, that in fact, Esau's living in and headed back into the land that's going to become Edom. And that Jacob is going to head into the land of Canaan, the land that they've been given by God. And he's going to go down into, so that place, Sukkoth, is probably on the border areas, not too far from Edom, but it's probably in Canaan. Because we're going to continue, and the way that this chapter ends, Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. So he's going to continue down, and he's in Canaan, in Shechem. When he came from Paddan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city, he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of silver. And he erected an altar there and called it Elohe, El Elohe Israel. So, we're in Canaan, in a city called Shechem. And he buys a parcel of land from the children of Hamor. And Hamor is Shechem's father. So it's kind of hard to understand, but evidently Hamor is so powerful that his kids have cities that they've established. And Shechem is the city that has been named after Shechem, probably. Okay. But it's in the same passage, so our assumption is now it could be, you know, a relative of Shechem, another Shechem. The city could be called after. But because with that, we see that happening several times in Genesis, where a name gets used for multiple places or people or whatever. But so he buys this piece of land and sets up shop outside of the city. So we have once again a story of one of Abraham's people not going into a city, but pitching a tent. I thought long and hard about this concept, because over and over and over again, we get told how rich and powerful these people are. Abraham and Lot were so rich and powerful, they had to split their areas. Jacob and Esau are in the same situation, extremely rich and powerful. These people are very, very rich and powerful. It would be very easy to make a city, or set up a city, or take over a city, or whatever it is. And they never do. They're always living in these tents. And I've always thought about, like, why? How strange that was. But they're always traveling, you know? And to me, this is more sort of, let's imagine that you're the people of Abraham, okay? And all of the people that you study and know about, the patriarchs, all traveled endlessly around the desert in different areas and pitched tents and stuff. If this was the people that you were, then it would be possible for you to do the same thing. Now, why does that matter? What matters, because if you spent several hundred years living in cities like Egypt and living in buildings, there has to be a way for these people to survive 40 years wandering around the desert. Not just physically, because God's going to take care of them, but psychologically. And who is it that writes all this down? Moses. So I think that Moses is telling them the stories of their people. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And recording all these things in some ceremonial format. You know, we don't know exactly, but we know we have tabernacles. We know we have church meetings basically going on, right? If he did this during this 40 years, it makes you feel at home in the desert in tents. Just like Jacob, just like Isaac, just like Abraham. The Bible does that. The Bible sets up connections. It's mystical in my mind, the way the connections are set up in the Bible. I'll give you a modern example of mystical connectivity, okay, that the Bible utilizes. African Americans, okay, slaves. There's no way that a slave would adopt the religion of a master, especially in the later days of their servitude when they were breaking away, right? You would be the opposite of that. You would hate that. But that's not what happened. In fact, the African American church is one of the cornerstones of everything, including Pentecostalism, including the AG church. So it's a cornerstone. Why? Because it doesn't matter what history and man says. The Bible spoke to those people. If I was a slave church leader or an African American early days of freedom church leader, this slavery thing that we're going to see and this suffering of Israel and all this stuff, to me, the Bible would identify with me more than it would the white master, right? It would identify with me and my people and our struggle. So this is a mystical way that the Bible, as a living thing, as something that is that big of a deal and that alive, reaches out and touches the hearts of millions of people that should have probably been anti-Christian, because the Christianity was the representative religion of the masters and of the enemy. but yet the Bible overcame. You're talking about overcoming suffering. You know, we've had suffering in our lives, and Jesus has helped us, and God has saved us, and we've overcome the suffering. We've been set free. We have things that radiant like break free. I think about that. Think about the African-American church. You're talking about overcoming suffering. The Bible was so powerful that you would have to steal it and hide it. But the slaves were still meeting and having church meetings. I mean, that just blows my mind. That's how powerful the Bible is. And I think that the same kind of connectivity happened with the Jews in the desert. It definitely was how they overcame the concentration camps. You know, you come out of concentration camps and get your own country. This is very biblical. The history of 1939 to 1975 is biblical when it comes to the Jewish people. And the leaders of the Jewish people that studied all this scripture were like, yeah, that's pretty much how it goes. Concentration camps, we get a country, pretty much how it goes. Get ready, everybody's going to attack us. But it's going to be okay because God's going to defend us. In every single country, what is it, 1973, 72, 73, something like that? Every single country around them attacks them all at once. A fledgling little country. Every single country around them that are full-fledged countries attacks. And they not only win, but they win land in all directions. That's so a God thing, it's just unbelievable. It's so obvious. If I was a Muslim leader and I was in like Jordan or wherever and I attacked and all that happened and I watched all that, I'd be like immediately Christian or Jewish, right? I'd be like, that's so obviously God. How can everyone attack all at once from all directions and not only everyone loses, but they expand their kingdom in all directions? God. It's the only explanation. But I mean, that's recent news. I mean, that's the 20th century we're talking about. Is still stuff like that happening today. God is the same, and Kelly has been hammering this for weeks. So if you have missed the fact that God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, I can't help you anymore. Okay? Because she's been hammering that. God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The way it functions and everything, you know, it's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. God, and we are people, so we do all kinds of weird stuff. And things get in the way, and religion gets in the way. All kinds of strange things happen, and we have battles over nothing. But, I mean, the bottom line is God's not changing. His plan is in place. It's always been in place.